We have a great guest today, retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, who served a lot of time in the Middle East and special operations. He's just got back from Israel. I think Sargis is going to be important for the listeners to understand what's breaking right now in the Middle East is significant with what happened in Saudi Arabia, what's going on in Iran. The show is going to be kind of an intense one because Sargis is a very brilliant guy. And, you know, I try to be careful because when we bring on special guests like him, who has a hand in things that sometimes are a bit covert, there are things that he can say and there are things that he cannot say. And I try to elicit from them as much as possible. Sargis Sangari, who had extensive combat experience in the Middle East as a special operations forces soldier, and even after retirement, for him it's never retirement. This guy works all the time. He advises fledgling Assyrian Christians. He does so much stuff. We love Sargis. Sargis, you just got back from the Middle East. Where were you, Sargis?
It was good to be back. I was actually in Israel. I was there for the international conference on counterterrorism with the International Institute for Counterterrorism itself.
What a time for you to be there. My gosh. And so what's the latest with Bibi Netanyahu? Apparently that's just not settled. Do you think that that's going to work out in his favor or how is that going to play out? What did you hear on the ground over there?
Part of what I did also, I was there and we monitored the elections and I had the pleasure and the opportunity to observe it directly from the Israeli National Radio perspective within their offices. I know there's been a big voter turnout. By 10 o'clock on the morning of the election, there was 15% of the vote that had been cast. That's the highest since 1984.
Wow.
And you're looking at reaching almost approximately 80% of eligible voters voting in the election. The problem that you're running into is Netanyahu himself. Netanyahu may not be able to formulate a government again. He has a lot of cases against him for corruption. There's two other ones that are in the pipeline that are coming up currently. One of them is very significant because it has to do with the submarines being sold to Egypt without the Israeli, their equivalent of the Central Intelligence Agency really knowing what was happening on the ground.
We haven't heard anything about that one, Sargis. Can you feed us a little background into what the story is behind that, if you could?
Well, look, Israel's in a decision point, okay? Their problem was what happened with Netanyahu's relationship with the previous POTUS, Barack Obama, pushed them to realize that we may need to kind of extend our footprint with others within the region. And unfortunately, Israel's kind of in an existential moment where they're looking at possibly going with China. My recommendation was that if you do that from the U.S., it's going to actually put you in a very bad position because they're thinking from a geostrategic alignment perspective that, well, if we're kind of hedging our bets with China, given we've had a relationship with them going back to even before Nixon was on the scene in China itself, maybe we could leverage the SCO and then with that possibly leverage a future relationship with Iran, which is the reason why China is currently developing the port of Haifa in Israel, and this year alone, the largest number of individuals who have tourists come to Israel is probably going to be Chinese tourists. But
that's interesting. And Sargis, can we just explain a little bit on the location of Haifa? Because people know that Israel, I mean, I've been there four times, but many people have never been there at all. They don't realize how tiny Israel is and who the neighbors are. You know, they've got Jordan and Egypt and Syria, etc. But the idea, Haifa is positioned in a place that's not too far from Tel Aviv. I mean, everything, you can drive one way or the other to Jerusalem, an hour here, an hour there, whatever. So, but I am absolutely surprised about China. So let me ask you this as well. Of course, when you come on the show, you know how it is, Sargis. You always make me think of about 10,000 questions. When we're talking about China, then And if Bibi is not, who's been such a loyal ally to the United States and in particular to Trump, does that mean then when we're having our own problems with China, they may go with China if he's not in place rather than supporting us?
Well, look, the problem with Bibi is that he's isolated a lot of people within his Likud party. When we were there and I took a look at the tea leaves, basically, it seems that what may happen, he's going to have 3 weeks to be able to put a coalition government together. If he can, he can request 2 more weeks extension. And if he's not able to do that, instead of heading to a third possible election, I think that the Likud party is probably going to move farther right. And if they do, you're looking at individuals like Gilad Erdan as being a possible main runner. That might be the next individual who's going to replace him if they go farther right. The problem that we have within the region and that they have, they're not sure of how to unravel the issues after President Trump leaves office, whether it be in 4 years or whenever the next individual comes in to replace the current POTUS.
Do they, other than Netanyahu, do they support President Trump, who's been a very strong advocate of Israel, moving the embassy to Jerusalem, et cetera? I mean, how is he seen there?
They love President Trump. Yeah, they love President Trump. They respect him. They're surprised that a lot of Americans, tourists who go there, are not do not speak well of President Trump. But they support him. They love him. The problem that they're running into, they realize that they have to address the issue of the Palestinian statehood. And the worry is that even under current President Trump, depending on how Israel moves forward, either it's going to be closer relationship with us in the long run on an economic basis, or it's going to be closer to China, which is expanding its footprint even in Syria currently, trying to take over as U.S. and Russia, as I've said in the past, are beating up each other within the region. The issue becomes that will President Trump put pressure on Israel economically and also at the same time on the Palestinians to force a final decision on a two-state solution? And part of that is you're looking at possibly Gaza Strip as being a portion of that, and then some areas within other territories that the Palestinians hold, in this case the West Bank. And then Jerusalem will remain the way it is currently. The problem that Israel has is there's a lot of settlers that are within those areas, and they're not going to be removed from those areas. I think that's
where
why.
Where are the settlers from? Are they Palestinian settlers? Where are they from?
These are Israeli settlers.
Settlers. Okay, I'm just trying to understand, because I know that there are Palestinians that are on the Knesset. Israeli Palestinians, I don't even know how they term that, but they have a very diverse Knesset. And I'm certain that they're not voting in favor of Netanyahu. I'm certain that they're voting in opposition to Netanyahu.
And they're voting in opposition to him. But look, one of the problems that you ran into, the parties before Israel went to the right and far right, the issue that drove them to that position was the fact that a lot of the Jews that came from the Arab countries after the Jews were kicked out of the rest of the Middle East ended up being settled by the Labor Party that was in power basically for 25 to 30 years into various areas there on the outskirts of Jerusalem. Because from the Labor Party, they saw those individuals as being not having enough education and were not capable possibly to be part of what they would like to build their core bases on. So they went more towards the Ashkenazi Jews, supporting them. In this case, those Jews that came from those countries felt that they were mistreated and badly, which pushed them towards being part of the Likud party, in this case, right party. And with the Palestinians being very talented as far as rejecting the ability of establishing a state, which they did in two occasions historically. They had 97% of the territory that was going to be given to them by the State of Israel, and then follow on with the terrorist attacks against the Jewish people, regardless of where they were. It really forced a lot of the Israelis just basically move to the right and stay there. And it's very difficult for them to kind of come back to the center to try to address some of these issues.
Do you think that Netanyahu, he's been in office now how many years? I mean, he's like one of the longest running or seated prime ministers. How many years has he been in office?
Yeah, he's been in as a prime minister since 2009. The only reason he kind of fell out of favor is because of the scandals. And I think he's in a very tough position to be able to formulate a capable Likud party. In the past, what he's done every time somebody has risen up to be a stronger candidate within the Likud, he's always said that those individuals are to the left of me. But in this case, there's a couple of individuals, and one that I named previously, more to his right. And I think that if Likud wins, for them to be able to get anywhere, they may have to go farther right to form a coalition government.
But if they do go farther right, they would still be probably pro-Trump, I would suspect.
No, they would be pro-Trump. That's a given, because most people in Israel like Trump. I mean, I've had talks with Israeli cab drivers, shop owners, people on the street, individuals within the government, that they all love Trump. But Trump is not going to be here permanently. Just
correct.
Like Netanyahu is not going to be there permanently. So,
correct.
And Israel has to start looking at where it needs to hedge its bets in the long run.
And you wrote about the significance of the backyard wars brewing with China. What exactly do you mean by a backyard war?
Well, I was asked by the editorial staff of the Daily Herald here in Chicago to kind of expand on some of my views that I've had as far as dissecting how the Middle East looks and how we from the Near East look at the relationship between the various different actors on the global stage. And the easiest way I could explain it to individuals from a layman's perspective was to kind of focus on the backyard, given that most people have a backyard, and anytime somebody gets into their backyard, we take certain measures to protect
right.
it. Everything that we have, investments are there. So from that concept, the backyard wars actually expanded into a different focus, maybe a broader kind of a focus than what you might say proxy wars.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully in the future, I'll be developing another set of writing for peer reviews that are going to expand a little bit more about how we look at the backyard wars.
Where can they get the article?
Because
as you talked about it being in the Daily Herald, but if they want to look you up online, Sargas, I want to mention that. I know we have you for a little bit longer, but I want to make sure that people hear it every segment.
They could go to the Near East Center for Strategic Engagement.com, and then they can follow us on Twitter. And pretty much all those articles I've written are there. This might be the last of the three articles I'm going to write for Daily Herald, because this year also I made the decision to, with the Republican Party approaching me in Chicago, that we're started collecting signatures and we're going to make a run towards Congress.
That's great.
For 2020. So
you have to keep us posted on that. Let me talk to you about what's happened with Saudi Arabia, because that's a big one. With the oil fields being bombed, they've likened that to Pearl Harbor. And a lot of people, I mean, thank God we're energy independent in this country, because it could have been a lot worse for the United States. But it certainly has affected the entire world. And I would certainly expect that Saudi Arabia is getting ready to retaliate. What did you find out when you were there? How can you paint a picture for us of what's going on?
Well, look, part of the reason I went to IDC Herzliya, we were at the counterterrorism, was taking a look at cyber terror and taking a look at these type of systems that are used by the enemy. When we were running the Assyrian military forces in Iraq and Syria, especially when it came to the Mosul clearing operation, the drones were used heavily by the enemy. It is a cheap item to have. It doesn't cost much to purchase. It could be armed easily, and that's the future of warfare. Unfortunately, it's not just Saudi Arabia. U.S. systems and infrastructures are very susceptible to these type of attacks. And Iran, having Hezbollah ties throughout the entire world, including the United States, can use those anytime against any of our infrastructures. Saudi Arabia, in this case, needs to take active measures to counter Iran. Till now, Saudi Arabia has not taken any type of active measure, even with all the equipment that we have given it through Title 22 purchases, which is foreign military sales, against Iran. So this is a moment where Saudi has to really step up and actually take some active measures against Iran and the attacks that took place against it. If it doesn't, Saudi Arabia, as I had said going back 4 years ago, might be on the verge of collapse to where it will be no longer in the state that it is today. It will be closer to what Yemen is currently.
Oh, well, then let me ask you about this, too, because, you know, remember the old king has got the younger prince now is taking over, the one that has been accused of having Khashoggi assassinated the journalist. Actually met that journalist. I went to Saudi Arabia, and he was not very pro-American. But the question is that guy a fit enough leader for Saudi Arabia? Is he wise enough to be able to lead? And are the other brothers who maybe are in the line of succession contemplating any kind of a takeover?
Well, if he was, he would not have been selected to be the lead. Saudi Arabia has to go through a reckoning internally. And we have taken certain active steps from the West and from other countries that are allies with Saudi to ensure it's put in a position where it has to truly take those leadership steps that it has not taken in the past.
But and if they're not taking them, Sargis, then something's wrong. I mean, something must be missing. That's what I kind of gather from what you've been saying. Or maybe I'm not reading between the lines.
Yes and no.
Well, what does that mean? What does yes and no mean?
That means for the betterment of this broadcast, there's something you can't talk about, but Saudi Arabia is in a position that he needs to take much more active steps towards Iran. Because, look, Saudi has a relationship with Israel currently for right. security measure requirements. But over the past 40 years, Saudi has never done anything to counter Iranian expansion within the region. And until it begins to do so, it will not be taken seriously as a viable capability. Look, Iran is ascending. The Shia within the region are ascending. Iran is much more powerful than the Sunni states have been able
to
be.
So how come they're not doing it, Sargis? I hear you. That's what I don't understand. I mean, I'm listening to what you're saying, but then I'm questioning. I'm saying if it's been happening and they know it's happening, why aren't they doing something? Are they not prepared? Do they do not have enough alliances in the area? What's the problem?
One, they're not capable. Two, they're not able to be the lead. Three, the Sunni structure of the tribal concept does not work well in modern world going forward in the 21st century and in the future.
And what does that millennia. And what does that mean? What does that mean? Why? Because they can't. They're not good generals.
The Sunnis are not capable. Have shown that they're not capable. Whether it be in Iraq, whether it be in the Arab uprisings that took place are not capable of showing their ability to be able to organize and lead on a world stage. Iran has been able to do that, and it's been doing it for rational reason more than non-rational reasons. Iran's operations are all tied to the protection of the regime. Iran will take steps that are, as much as we think, are ridiculous, are actually calculated and are tied to a long-term foreign policy where it's able to be, even with the sanctions against it, equivalent
right.
to where it could sit across the table from all the Western nations to strike a deal with them.
Well, let me ask you this then, Sargis, because you're going to think this is silly, but that's okay. I'm asking you any because you'll give me a straight shot. I saw the movie the other day, Lawrence of Arabia, with David Lean's great masterpiece. Saudi Arabia is so rich. Why aren't they hiring independent people from around the world that have that expertise and bring them in to help them?
They have hired them. They're just not able to be a leader on the world stage. Look, when Muhammad brought the Islam into the Middle East region, he brought the Arab culture, and Arab culture ran smack into the Persian culture. The Persian culture, while the Arab was a tribal Bedouin, had actually an empire, had been a leader on the global stage, the concept, as much as Iranians turn to be Shia, in this case, accepted Islam, they still operate from that perspective. Saudi Arabia was a carved-out nation under the Sykes-Picot Agreement, and would not have existed if the Western powers at that time, England and France, had not created them to exist. So it is still the Bedouin cultural concept that is very difficult to be able to control in order for it to be able to operate at a global stage level as an equal partner with other nations that need it to be able to take those leadership roles in the region.
We're talking with a great Sargas Zangari, who's a good friend of the show and has seen so much time in the Middle East as a special operations forces soldier. And we have so many questions remaining. Sargas, so I'm looking at the Middle East. You know, we've got issues in Afghanistan. We've got problems with Iran. We're looking at Saudi Arabia. We're looking even at Jordan. I mean, Jordan and Egypt in the middle of all of this stuff and Syria. How is that playing out? If you can give us a little read, because they're all together there. They're all pretty close by.
Well, Egypt is easy because Egypt military really, they know that their future is tied to a close relationship with Israel because of all the military, for the better term we use, industrial complex that is controlled by them, and that's literally their lifeline. So they will be good enduring partners for the state of Israel. As far as Jordan is concerned, it has a lot of internal issues with the Palestinian crisis. Don't be surprised if, depending on how Saudi settles itself, that Jordan might be the next on the chopping block.
Wow.
As far as Syria is concerned, Syria will continue to bleed itself out. As I've said in the past, maybe a four-year run. However, China, to buffer us against what we are doing to them with the sanctions, is expanding its footprint in Syria, tied to the communities that have been settled in China itself, you know, going back a long time ago. With $400 billion possibly being available for development, I think China has a means and ways to get into Syria, especially through its proxies with Iran and its China cooperation.
I'm telling you, people don't realize it's even like countries like Sudan or South Sudan. You know, the United States, when we go in and deal with a lot of these countries, we don't play bribes. We don't, or at least we're not supposed to as a federal government. And they have no problem with it in China. So you've got Syria, you've got all these other countries that basically could be the enemy of my enemy is my friend. They're using leverage much like they do with North Korea. This is kind of we're looking at a dangerous map here.
Well, look, I think part of what we're trying to achieve in the broader sense with China is to make sure that the current leadership, whose anniversary is coming up now soon, will possibly take a step back. The concept of China's global expansion, as it has been pushing, even today we have the Australian PM in the States, his nation, which we look at from the U.S. perspective as being kind of a launching point for us to be able to buffer China within Southeast Asia, has had a lot of Chinese companies tied directly into it.
Oh, yeah.
To include five of his family members from the leadership of China living in Australia themselves, which is a means of ways by which China influences politics, in this case, in Australia and even in the United States.
But they also have a big influence, Sargas, from the Middle East as well. They have a lot from Afghanistan, Pakistan, you know, Palestine. I mean, all over from the Middle East have settled. A lot of them have settled in Australia.
Well, look, they're able to do that. But like, as an example, they've had major influence in Pakistan and Afghanistan. The way we buffered against that was, when we put sanctions against Iran from the U.S. perspective, we kept the port of Chabahar open for India, which is a major block against China, to be able to develop the port there in Iran and run a railhead directly into Afghanistan, which means we can destabilize China's ability to use its ground capabilities into Europe through Afghanistan. At the same time, when we do that, we put pressure on them because they have basically purchased every member of the Pakistan government on their payroll through contracts with companies. And if we're able to buffer against that and put Pakistan in the position where it's destabilized when it comes to economic interest, then China has to pick up all these sunk costs. So our ability to tie China to these countries as they're economically failing is the only way we can push them to make an internal change economically, politically within China, and possibly have a different lead for us to negotiate with.
We don't have a lot of time left, but I want to ask you real quickly. So when are we going to know whether you're running for Congress or not? We got to know that, Mr. Sargis Sangari. We got to know that, Colonel. What's the story?
Well, look, we're collecting signatures. It's going to be difficult. I'm a Republican running in Illinois, and I'm going to be running against a 10-time incumbent, so it's not going to be easy. But I chose that route because I think a change is needed. A lot of years, we've talked and you've heard me on your show. We give a lot of intel, information, support for the various different people within the system. But I realize at the end of the day, if you're not at the table, we really don't have a say to getting things corrected. And unfortunately, I think for the betterment of the country, we need to see a lot of veterans on both sides, Democrat or Republican, to run and be at the table so we could get this country to the right direction.
Oh, I couldn't agree more. And right now, I mean, I keep using the term tipping point, because with experience like yours, how long were you serving in the Middle East on special operations? How many years?
Well, look, I mean, I was 20 years in. My focus was there, Middle East, because of my background. I was 6 years continuous areas combat operations in the Middle East since the war began. So from 2006 all the way to 2010, I was really Middle East focused. Middle East is a place where we could make it or break it. We have to resolve the issues of Syria, and once those issues are resolved, we could finally resolve the issue with North Korea, and then slowly that untangles our friction points with Iran. I think we can have a reset and possibly, hopefully, head towards development over
Absolutely.
The next 2-3 decades.
You're really right, Sargis. And when you're in Israel, you know, you realize that it's like being in a small state bordering another state, but they're all countries. And it's the only real democracy in all of those in that area. And you just kind of cannot believe that that little place can stay so strong and it's so small. It's kind of impressive.
Look, it's difficult. It's not easy. And unfortunately, I think a lot of the members of even the Jewish community in the States have forgotten what it took to establish the State of Israel and what it takes to maintain it. And hopefully
Absolutely.
We're able to...
Well, you've got to come back on. Once you get it figured out whether you're going to be get the signatures, we want you coming back and let us know if you're going to be running for Congress. We're always grateful to have you. Thank you, retired Lieutenant Colonel Sargis Sangari, for joining us here on The Hard Question. And thank you all for joining us.